the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to the 27th podcast of Civitalk. We're going to get down and dirty with a lot of politics today. Probably a little less dirty, more down. And we're also going to talk North Carolina governor's race with potential Dan Forrest and Governor Roy Cooper matchup. And we'll jump around a little bit, politicizing the Super Bowl, talk a little bit of legal and judicial stuff, and just close maybe with a few surprises. So, Brooke, how are you doing today?
Doing really well. Been having a good day here in the office. It's been pretty quiet, though.
Yeah, it's been quiet, and I've gotten a lot done because of that. It's been good.
We did make a little music video, though, earlier.
Yeah, Brooke loves to do videos, and she's doing a good job with those. So if you're friends with her on Facebook, I'm sure you've seen it, and we'll see more of that.
Yes, because I just downloaded the TikTok app, and my daughter, my 15-year-old daughter, she was just shaking her head at me last night because I have my 10-year-old daughter recording videos of me doing like some of the popular songs and dance moves. And my 15-year-old was like, "Mom, why are you doing that?" I was clearly embarrassing her. But you know what? I wouldn't be doing my job as a parent.
I have no idea what the TikTok app is.
That's the video that we recorded earlier today. That's the app.
Could you explain that to our viewers or our listeners over 15? What that is?
It's just, so you choose like a popular song and the music plays and you're supposed to be dancing to it and lip singing. So kind of like karaoke, except it's their voices, not yours, but you're pretending like you're singing and it makes you look cool.
Crazy.
So anyway,
Brooke, what do you think of all this cold weather in the Midwest?
Oh my goodness. It's wild.
It is wild.
And I'm supposed to fly up north. Well, just a little north up to DC later on this week. And I was looking, the high, I think, is 25 degrees.
Like super warm compared to the Midwest right now.
That's true. Because Chicago, Illinois is going to be just as cold, if not colder, than Antarctica over the next few days.
Yeah. Yeah. The wind chill. I've been to Chicago a lot. My wife finished law school there. And you know, I met her when she was in law school. And I would go visit her when I was living in Grand Rapids, which I can go into cold stories about that too. But the way the wind in February would whip between those buildings in Chicago is brutal. It'll make you cry out for your mom. I mean, it's ridiculous.
That sounds horrendous. So I lived in Kansas State for a little while. And just even having, I don't know, I think we had 60 days of it being below freezing. And it was just, I didn't even want to leave my house. Like if they had Amazon food delivery services at that time, I totally wouldn't have left my house. But it was just miserable.
Yeah, so it's definitely a character building exercise. When I first moved up to Grand Rapids, even though I had lived up in the north before in my life, because my dad was in the Air Force and we move around. But I remember the first winter, it was like negative 13 or 14 outside. And I had to scrape the ice off the inside of my windshield. I'd never done that before. And it was like, I mean, it almost just makes you want to cry when you're like trying to scrape ice off the inside of your windshield.
That sounds miserable. Yeah, but like you said, character building.
It does build character. Sure. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, there's some winter sports that are fun. But
if you're watching them from the comfort of your home, that's right. About it. But anyways, yeah. So the 2020 governor's race is already starting to take shape here in the state, isn't it?
Yeah, everything, you know, now that we've politicized everything in culture, we got to move up the times of the races. And you have Dan Forrest, who announced his exploratory committee. And I think everybody knew that Dan Forrest was going to challenge Roy Cooper. That's been the matchup that we've all expected, right? I mean, Dan Forrest, Roy Cooper, some people had speculated that McCrory was going to jump back in and try to retake the governor's mansion. But I've always kind of felt like it has always been a Dan Forrest Roy Cooper matchup. And, you know, Forrest is the top vote getter in all of North Carolina this last presidential election. I mean, he got more votes than Roy Cooper, but he also got more votes than Donald Trump. So, I mean,
oh, did he?
Yeah, he's a contender. Wow. He was the top vote getter in North Carolina in 2016.
So you think this will actually be a fierce matchup despite the governor's really strong approval ratings?
It's hard to say, Brooke. I mean, if I was a betting man, I would definitely bet on Roy Cooper to get reelected today. Just because, you know, it's hard to take out an incumbent, and we'll see how, you know, the anti-Trump sort of bandwagon goes along. That could potentially help Cooper a lot. And but, you know, Cooper's up campaigning in New York, or he announced that he's going to be running for governor from New York City today.
Isn't that strange?
That's really bizarre. It just doesn't sound...
Why are you going to make your North Carolina gubernatorial candidate announcement from New York City.
Well, he's certainly raising money off of HB2 still, so I mean, that's part of what's going on there.
Well, and HB2 is going to become an issue again, right? Because wasn't that wasn't there the bill only going to last until 2020?
I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's correct. And so he's getting some input from his big liberal donors on how to navigate HB2 and kind of use it as a wedge issue again. He did it very effectively. I mean, he basically said that businesses were being held hostage and couldn't come to North Carolina because of HB2, and he was able to use a lot of the business class to his advantage. Leveraging that to his advantage. Very effective.
For him.
I know a lot of people in North Carolina, because people will come up to me or they're talking about politics. It's like, I don't understand the people that voted for Trump and Roy Cooper. But I actually knew some of those people because they were younger. They tend to be more conservative, but they were upset about HB2. And I don't think that McCrory lost just because of HB2. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that there were people that voted for Trump and voted for Cooper who probably would have not voted for a Democrat governor because of HB2.
Mm-hmm. And like we said, that's going to become an issue again. So I think it will be interesting to see how that plays into the conversation, because Forrest, it was very clear where he stood on that, and he was a proponent of HB2. And so we'll see how much that plays into the conversation, or if Forrest and his team will begin to kind of just commandeer the narrative towards some other policy issues. So very interesting.
I think it's interesting that what is your take just on the New York thing again? I mean, I don't understand what his advisors, it just seems like not a great move for him to sort of do this kickoff from New York City. I mean, is this the official kickoff? It seems like he'll have to come back and do something in North Carolina now, because Dan Forrest is not going to forget about this moment. I think this is going to become an ad moment. And I was interested in, you've seen the ad, right, of the Forrest campaign.
Yeah,
it's not very
it.
Ideological. I mean, there's no really ideology to it. It's all about unifying. And I think that's probably an effective tactic for him to go out a little less ideological, because everybody knows Dan Forrest is a conservative, and, he's worn that mantle very well. He's spoken at Civitas events. I mean, he's known for his conservative bona fides, so to speak. So
yeah, I think when it comes to Governor Cooper being up there, well, first off, I think it's interesting because while he's up there announcing his intentions to run again in 2020, Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest will be the acting governor whenever the governor is out of the state.
Right.
So he's the acting governor.
I hope he does so much right now,
He could maybe appoint the retiring Supreme Court justice.
Probably not, Brooke.
But I think that optically does not look good. Now, will those that are loyal to Cooper anyways care? No. They're not going to care. Does the news really care? Probably not. Like,
there's so many New Yorkers in North Carolina now. I mean, it's almost like he's going to the satellite state,
satellite
to sit
state.
Out, do a fist bump to all the New Yorkers down here in the Triangle, in Charlotte area.
So I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's a good look, but clearly his people think that, his image can handle that. And I would say his approval numbers indicate that.
Yeah, they're
that,
always so. Good in the Civitas polls, his approval numbers. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can go and check our polling out over the last year and see how high Cooper's done. I mean, he's polled fairly well. And I think part of that is there's two-pronged effect to that. I think a lot of people just kind of view him as this moderate, when I see him a little bit more as hard left governor here in North Carolina. And I think a lot of people just don't know much about him, because the General Assembly has pushed so much of the agenda. I mean, he's been around North Carolina politics for a long time, but, he hasn't really pushed the agenda, so to speak, because of the supermajority that's now gone.
Right. So he hasn't had to actually propose policies that would get him into the fray. It's more like, this is what I'm standing against with respect to what the GOP is doing. But he didn't even have a lot of name ID until Hurricane Florence.
Right.
So that was something that just a lot of North Carolinians weren't really attuned to the state level issues. Obviously, the hurricane impacted that and so put him in front of the screens a lot more. But yeah, we'll see what happens. I would look forward to a really good debate between him and whoever else ends up running. I'm wondering if other Republicans will throw their hats into the race, or if they will allow Forrest to run as the lone Republican on this. We'll see.
I would not be surprised if they allow Forrest to run as the lone Republican.
Yeah?
I think as the top vote getter in 2016, he definitely, even for maybe some of the flaws or the timing's not great to run as a conservative, so to speak. I mean, he definitely has those votes to back him up and say, hey, he's a guy that knows how to go out there and get votes.
Yeah, he does. He's been in this for a long time. So he does know how to campaign. So that will be interesting to see. But let's go ahead and shift to the national level, because it's more politics there. And the Democratic playing field is getting denser and denser as the days go by.
Who's your favorite? I mean, not necessarily who you think is going to get the nomination, but who do you like? You know, just, I'm not talking from an ideological perspective, but maybe just personally, from some of the candidates that are kind of in the ring, so to speak, right now.
That's tough. Can I start with who I don't like?
Yeah, there's a lot of them. I definitely don't like Kamala Harris.
Yeah, I don't like how she handled the whole Judge Kavanaugh confirmation thing. But I'd say Tulsi is likable enough.
She's likable, yeah. I mean, she's served.
And it's not just because she's Pacific Islander.
She served her country in the military, and yeah. So few candidates do that now. I mean, it used to be almost a prerequisite to run for president that you had to have military experience, and you know, that's not really a prerequisite anymore.
Yeah, it's not. But yeah, she seems likable enough. I don't know, but she hasn't been in front of the screens a lot, so it's not like there's been a lot of opportunities to not like her.
She used to support marriage, and then she got in trouble for that, and she's had to apologize profusely because she was part of an initiative in Hawaii years ago when all that gay marriage stuff was going on in Hawaii. She tried to block that through an organization with her father, yeah, to try to block that from happening. It ended up not happening there.
Yeah,
well, but she's had to apologize profusely for being involved in that. She said she was mistaken.
She's not
just to get background on her.
Yeah, well, she's not the only Democrat that walks back things and looks very ideologically inconsistent. And there's plenty of conservatives and Republicans that do the same thing. But when the cultural winds change, all of a sudden, I was against and now I'm for.
Kristen Gillibrand's another one that I think that supported marriage and then had to profusely apologize. So. Yeah. There are others. It's not just Tulsi.
Yeah, but I think Bloomberg is a little bit more moderate than some of the other ones. I think he's not as hard left as Harris or Warren, I'd say. So if anything, I think he would kind of shift the conversation a little more center. Now I use that term loosely, center on the.
He's a big time gun grabber, so.
Well, yeah, that's a concern, right? But I'm just saying. He's not an outright socialist like Sanders.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, you have Kamala Harris that said she would ban private health insurance the other mm-hmm. day. So you certainly have that more hard left socialist where he's not in that camp, so to speak.
Exactly. So I think that, you know, somebody, one of my friends on Twitter proposed the other day about whether or not, you know, if you're a registered Republican and Trump does not have a primary opponent and you can vote in the Democratic primary, who would you vote for to try to kind of shape the field there? And I think that that's something to consider if someone wants to go that route. But I don't think there's enough collective efforts to actually do something about that. But
what about Hillary? She says that she's not out of the mix, that you can't forget about her, that she could throw her hat in the ring.
Whatever. I don't know. That's kind of cheap talk to me.
Candidates, it could help her, though. I mean, it could help her. She could raise money. Her dollar would go farther. She has name recognition. I'm just playing devil's advocate. Like, I don't think she has a chance to win the nomination. I'm just playing devil's advocate and going out there and saying, whoa, she could say, there's just so many people. I can go in there and carve out 15%.
Well, she might take a tip from Nancy Pelosi, because that actually was effective for Pelosi in getting the House speakership again. Although some of the younger people were saying, no, let others get in. And she had some resistance. But
now she's a hero again.
Now she's the hero.
Up to Trump.
Yeah. So we'll see. I don't know. But Howard Schultz is another one.
Yeah.
But he's the CEO of Starbucks, or the founder of Starbucks. And so he has talked about running. But there has been a ton of liberal backlash on that, because he's talked about running as an independent.
Right.
And he's a billionaire, obviously. But he started out, grew up in the projects, and you know, it's kind of this American dream story. And so he doesn't support some of the radical measures that others on the far left do. And so there's this appeal that maybe some independents would have toward him that the far left would not. And that obviously would upset, that upsets many in the Democratic Party, because they feel like he would take votes away from them and thereby secure Donald Trump's second term.
So. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Yep. Elizabeth Warren, she's another name. Just to throw out a couple other names, Julian Castro, who was a former mayor of San Antonio. He was, you know, considered one of the top rising stars, but he's been kind of overshadowed by all these other characters and overshadowed by Beto in Texas. So,
I bet a Beto-Biden ticket or a Biden-Beto ticket would do really well.
I think that's potentially, you know, what we're looking at. So that definitely has a potential to do well. I mean, it's two white guys, though. So would the Democrats be able to handle that? I know that a lot of people think that Beto is Hispanic, but he's Irish. So, you know, I don't know if they would be willing to handle that, because I know that the identity politics crowd might push up. But, you know, I think they'll be united because they just want to get rid of Trump, right? So they're willing to swallow on some of their pet issues, like identity politics, maybe just to get rid of Trump.
Yeah, I think so, too. So we'll see which element of the Democratic Party really is able to wield their power and actually get their candidate on, because right now it is a very divided field, but we'll see who they coalesce around. So let's transition, though, because I want to talk about something that you got published yesterday in the News and Observer. And that's the Medicaid expansion article.
Yeah, I wrote just a piece. What I wanted to do, Brooke, was tie it to federal spending, because we focus on Medicaid expansion, how it's good for the poor or how it's not good for the poor, or how it's this or it's that. And I just wanted to focus on federal spending and just take a step back and kind of look at it from a 10,000 you know, foot view and say, hey, in terms of expanding Medicaid, what are we doing to our federal debt and deficit? The CBO has said if a state doesn't expand Medicaid, it doesn't add to the spending. One of the big myths that you see on the right and left and from Republicans and Democrats is that there's this magic pot of money, Brooke, that is just sitting there waiting to be spent. And, you know, one of Roy Cooper's big arguments is that if we don't tap into this, it's going to be sent to Kansas, or it's going to be sent to Ohio, or it's going to be sent to Florida, or it's going to be sent somewhere else. And, you know, that's not true.
It's not how it works.
It's not how it works. We're spending, the point of my piece is, we're spending through debt and deficit, basically crushing the future generations of this country, where they're just going to be taxed so heavily to pay for all this stuff, and they're not going to be able to flourish from an economic standpoint because they'll be so beholden to the government because of the debt and deficit. And it's really depressing to me, to be honest, because there's no moral courage in Washington to do anything on this stuff. And it's up to the onus of states like North Carolina to say, hey, let's not add. If we can help it, let's not go out and add to the debt and deficit. And like Civitas will continue to point out, this is not a good program for poor people. This is not good for the state economy either. It's not good for the state budget, but it's certainly detrimental to the federal budget. And this cost sharing will certainly not be 90% of the federal government continuing to add that up. It'll go back to traditional cost sharing, which is more like 65%. And it'll bankrupt the state of North Carolina. And they'll be so beholden to this program that they won't be able to build roads and invest in education and things that need to be invested in, instead of a broken federal government. And so it's not compassionate, Brooke, to bankrupt this nation. I've never understood that argument that we need more and more government. It's one thing if we're paying for those things and we can disagree with those policies, but all we're doing is taxing future generations and breaking their backs. And, you know, kids like yours and kids like mine, they're going to live in a totally different country if we can't get spending under control.
That's a really good point. And you hit the nail on the head when you said it's not compassionate. And that's the primary issue, I would say, is, you know, for all of the platitudes that the left issues when it comes to being compassionate and caring about the poor, this is something that just because someone has health care insurance doesn't mean they're actually having access to the health care that they've been promised. And that's another problem when it comes to Medicaid expansion. Since 2008, over 3,000 doctors in the state of North Carolina have stopped accepting Medicaid. And so it's just not profitable enough for them to continue to do so. And yet if we add over 500,000, maybe even 750,000 more North Carolinians on the Medicaid rolls, that's further crowding out that system. And if trends continue, there's fewer and fewer doctors actually accepting it. So it's going to create this access crisis as well, not to mention the fiscal issues that Ray raised. And then 77% of those that would be covered under this new expansion are working age, able-bodied, childless adults. And so there's a lot of other things to consider. I was actually at John Locke Foundation yesterday when Secretary Mandy Cohen of the Department of Health and Human Services under the Cooper administration spoke to the audience there. And she was, you know, telling the Cooper administration's plan to expand Medicaid. And, you know, she's a very likable person, seemed very kind. And so respect her for coming to what she knew was going to be maybe a less agreeable audience to her ideas. And I think that, the end goal is still the same for both sides on this. It's we want Americans and North Carolinians to be able to access healthcare to meet the needs that they have. But the methods that we're suggesting and proposing to go about it are two totally different ones. And I would say that Civitas and other free market policy organizations have more sustainable solutions that still protect individual liberty while being compassionate and actually helping the most needy North Carolinians.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I think we're living in a different world. I mean, you have candidates for president now openly saying that they want to abolish private health insurance. So, you know, the goal is single payer. And you can go talk to people who have suffered under single payer. I mean, it's not going to be good for this country. There's just no way, even with some of the brokenness that we needs to be reformed within healthcare, using single payer as a solution will be devastating to the chronically ill. Basically anybody that needs to see a doctor, the waiting list, specialists, it will be a huge catastrophe for this nation. It also will bankrupt this nation even more than we're already financially and fiscally bankrupt. But to me, that is just anybody who has health problems or health concerns. The only thing to be is just super healthy if we go to a single payer system and just hope you're always healthy for the rest of your life, because that will be a disaster for this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, and someone posted a comment on our Facebook feed and said we wouldn't be saddling future generations with debt if we raised taxes and paid for these things now. But there's such a thing as getting taxed into oblivion, and what right?
Yeah,
do
I mean,
our
the revenue curve only goes so far. Once you start taxing people at a certain rate, the revenue starts going down, right? I mean, that's just how it works. That's a good point. And I don't disagree. If we tax people more to pay for certain things, and if you're actually paying for it and not running these huge deficits in debt, it's not ideal economically, but at least you're not, you know, spending the future generation, the money of future generations who really have no say in this political process. I mean, to have an example of taxation without representation, that's the biggest example. It's not the British so much. Long ago, it's this idea of taxing people three and four generations out that have no say in this process and are going to be left with the bill. And what it shows is moral cowardice by the leaders in this country to do anything about this. And it's disappointing for me to see, because I know we all have congressmen or senators that we admire, but so many of them up there are willing to kick the can down the road and preserve their own careers, preserve their own pensions, preserve their own way of life, than deal with this spending that's going on in this nation. I mean, just go on to the debt clock, usdebtclock.com or .org, wherever it is, and watch that thing spin, because it's insane that nobody in Washington will address this.
Yeah, well, we're going to keep speaking about it, and hopefully more and more Americans do and actually put their foot down and stop asking for bigger government, because when you expect something for you and your team, you are thereby requiring other taxpayers pitch in to cover those things, whereas the private sector and the nonprofit world is much better equipped to meet the needs that are actually on the ground for citizens, and local governments are better equipped to do that. But that requires an involved citizenry. So if you want to learn more about this and read Ray's op-ed, you can go to News and Observer's website. They have it there. We've also posted it on our Facebook and Twitter accounts, so you can go check it out at Civitas Institute on Facebook or NC Civitas if you are using Twitter.
And thanks to the News and Observer for publishing it. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much. So Ray, this Sunday is Super Bowl Sunday. Are you going to watch it?
I probably will, just because it'll be on and, you know, it's a thing to do. I'm still a little upset because I like the Saints, and they were, I don't know, you probably haven't kept up with the officiating in the Super Bowl, because Brooke doesn't know anything about sports, and she's proud of it, and that's okay.
As long as you own it and you're proud of it.
But yeah, I mean, I wanted the Saints to be in the Super Bowl, and they got gypped by the officials, and so it'll be the Rams and the Patriots, and so yeah, I'll watch it, but I don't know if I really care that much about who wins.
Mm-hmm. You don't have a dog in this fight, so... Yeah, well, so there was a recent survey released by Morning Consult, and they were talking about how Americans feel about the politicizing of sports in our country. It really kind of took this whole new, sports took this whole new look once Colin Kaepernick began his kneeling protest, and that really launched a national discussion and dialogue about politics and sports. And so I was reading this survey by Morning Consult, and it says that nearly two-thirds of consumers believe the Super Bowl is an inappropriate place for advertisers to make political statements, compared with 20% that think it is appropriate. I don't know. I mean, despite, like, let's say there was a conservative cause that was being championed during the Super Bowl, do you think it's appropriate or not, or does it matter?
Well, I'm a free speech guy, so I'm okay with more liberty and license in that area. Ultimately, it's up to the networks to some degree what they show. I understand that. I mean, you know, they're certainly, it's their network, so they can show their own discretion as a private company, and they bid on the Super Bowl, so to speak. But so I would be a little bit more live and let live, letting people as long as it's not unnecessarily divisive or unnecessarily hostile, then I would have no problem with it. I guess I don't get triggered like some people about things. If I disagree with something, I keep it in my mind, think critically about it, maybe come back to it later, but I don't get triggered, or I don't get hostile. I don't run to social media to tweet about how triggered I got and then demand people get fired and all this stuff. So, you know, I don't really have a huge problem with it. I think you can certainly over-politicize, you know, with your ads. And I think we've seen that before in the Super Bowl and just sports in general. I mean, sports writers are often some of the most political people because they're, you know, maybe they're a little bit ticked off that they don't get as much respect being a sports reporter. So they go overboard with some of their politics. But, you know, it'd be interesting to see if what sneaks in and how it sneaks in. So, but I don't have a major problem with it. But there's always a danger when, you know, everything gets politicized in our society. We've talked a lot about that on this podcast. So I'm
think
go
you
there.
Just you just do what your brand can handle. So Gillette made a decision not too long ago, and there was this whole hoopla around Gillette being opposed to toxic masculinity versus traditional masculinity. And it just, to me, it actually... It highlighted the conversation that we're already having as a nation. And so, yeah, I can understand brands taking political stances. And I just figure consumers like myself just make a decision on whether or not we want to continue patronizing that brand and using their products.
Right.
It's just, it's not a big deal to me. But if the Super Bowl becomes even more like the Oscars, I think they'll just continue to lose viewers because a lot of people just don't like the overt politicization. They're okay with some of it, but by and large, they just want to watch the sport for the love of the sport.
Yeah, people are tired of just having stuff crammed down their throat. So I think if they feel like they're having stuff crammed down their throat, then they get tired of that and they backlash. That's the reason why we have President Trump. Like him, love him, hate him, whatever. He's a big reason of that because people are just tired of being told what to think, what to say. I think there's just a fatigue with that. And now that it's bleeding over to sports and trying to politicize everything in our life, you know, people push back against that. They're sick of it.
Yeah. Well, politics can be a consuming thing if we don't push back, right? And we don't spend time just with our families and not caring about what's going on in Washington.
Right.
But when we continue to support bigger government initiatives that require
everything
this,
to be federalized and everything, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Then it's inevitable that we're going to have these conversations surrounding everything from education to Super Bowls. So, anyways, if you're tired of this sort of discussion all the time, then, you know, support civil society, support the private sector and things like that. And let's see how we can maybe make more progress on that front. But we need to wrap up this show, but let's touch on a recent announcement that happened this week pertaining to the North Carolina Supreme Court.
Yeah, Mark Martin, Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court, is retiring. And I don't know exactly when his term runs out or when he's leaving that seat, but he will be the dean of the law school at Regent University.
My alma
so
mater.
There you go. And Phil Berger Jr. has expressed interest in running in 2020, but in the meanwhile, Governor Cooper gets to make an appointment, and certainly originalists and people who are support a strong rule of law are upset that maybe that the court will be tipping much further to the left than it already has in the last year. So
yep, 6-1 is what the makeup will be like. And so, you know, there's a lot of gerrymandering cases to be had here in the state of North Carolina, redistricting and things like that. There was a lawsuit filed by the Southern Coalition for Social Justice right after the General Assembly overrode Cooper's voter ID veto. And so I'm sure that's going to be before the Supreme Court, and with a very left-leaning court now, that will certainly have implications on North Carolina state policy and how the Constitution is interpreted. We just passed constitutional amendments for voter ID, capping the income tax limit to 7%, among other things, the right to hunt and fish. So this does have serious implications for the state of North Carolina.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest issues facing North Carolina is its judicial makeup because of so many things that are drug into the courts, sometimes federal court, but a lot of it's just drug into the state court. And it'll be a big, big moment going forward, just how this next election shapes out again for the court. I mean, it may take years to sort of, if you're a conservative and you want to see more originalist justice and more tied to their rule of law here in the state instead of just judicial activism, then, you know, this is something to follow.
Absolutely. It's big. Yep. So we'll keep you guys posted on that because Governor Cooper is already looking at possible appointees to fill Justice Martin's position. So we will be writing on that, I'm sure, as well. But you guys keep up with us. NCCivitas.org. That's where all of our newest content is at. And always on Facebook, we welcome your feedback, your comments. You can shoot us an email at radio@nccivitas.org anytime you want to get in touch with us as well.
Yeah, and if you want to be a financial contributor to the Civitas Institute, we'd appreciate that too. Remember us in your yearly giving, especially. So we really appreciate your support, and we appreciate our audience here.
Yeah, thank you guys. Have a good week.
Thank you.